Welcome back to the podcast, Casey McConnell. Is this your second time or third time being on?
Third, I think.
How's Hoonah breaking out of the winter? It's been pretty nice down here. Sunny last week. We did have a little bit of snow, like way up top, because it was pretty chilly overnight. But yeah, been pretty nice.
Yeah, it's been a lot of bluebird days and frosty in the morning still, but heating up to 55, 60 during the day. So that's been great.
You a little worried at all about the amount of snowfall, or are you guys pretty good to go? I know sometimes we get a little bit concerned because we look up top and there's not a whole lot of snow. So we think about the rivers not being able to be really ideal for salmon later on in the year unless we just get a ton of rain.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We did get a lot of precipitation this winter, but it was a little warmer at sea level, so it didn't stack up too much down low. But I think up high has quite a bit of snow still. The pass that goes from Hoonah to the freshwater bay on the logging roads, they plowed it a few weeks ago or last week, and there's still 4 or 5 feet in the pass, which is only about 800 feet elevation. So I'm sure up higher there's more.
Nice. Yeah, it's so nice when you can go through the winter without getting a ton in town, but you still get enough up on the mountains so that it can melt and the salmon will be in good shape.
Yeah, that's the Goldilocks zone where we don't have to shovel that much, but environmentally everything's fine.
Yeah, for sure. So you're getting ready for the summer season?
Yep, we just had our Coast Guard inspection of our inspected boat today. That went well, and now we're ready to go.
What does that entail?
They either one or two people, depending on the size of the boat, will come on board and just basically inspect all the systems of the vessel, make sure you have the right number of, like the different flares. You have to have the right number of life jackets, just kind of basic safety stuff. Make sure you have the right log books and paperwork and everything. And even on our pretty basic boat, it took about 3 hours just to go through all the systems.
What is that boat?
And that, it's a 40-foot catamaran. It's, just 13 passenger whale watching. Yeah, it's even with no like issues or no, hiccups, it's still about 3 hours. So
yeah, that's a big boat, man. That's a sea going vessel.
Yeah. It's when we got it, we were like, we have a 33-foot boat that's built in Port Angeles by the same builder and designed by the same designer. That's he's based in New Zealand. We're like, oh, that one's 33 feet. We'll just get a little bit longer. We'll go 40 feet, but it's twice as big. From 33 to 40 is huge.
Yeah. How many people? You said 13 people can go on there?
Yeah, we just take 13 passengers. That's how much can fit in our little van. Yeah. It just kind of keeps it simple.
Yeah, I think the experience that people really like is not being crowded onto a boat, just packed in there like sardines, having at least a little bit of space. Sharing it with some people is fine, but when you start to get that feeling that you're just one of many head that's being charged to be on the thing, I think the people appreciate a little smaller crowd.
Yeah, that's kind of our niche. A lot of times we just have, a big family or one or two groups, and so it's still pretty intimate, but can kind of, take a few more people than just six at a time.
Mm-hmm. When did you guys start that? Like, what year did you start the business?
Oh, my parents started doing that in the late 90s, mid-90s, and Glacier Wind Charters started as just fishing charters. Both my parents were teachers, so they had summers off. And they did a little bed and breakfast with charter fishing. And then basically as cruising started becoming the main method that people were visiting Southeast Alaska, we kind of shifted more to the eco tours and photography trips. And then basically now with so many cruise ship passengers, we just do the shorter day trips and have shifted away from fishing completely.
Mm-hmm. When did they really start going into Hoonah? I know gosh, in that it had to have been late 80s that a smaller cruise ship came into Klawock, and then there wasn't a dock. They just tended them in, and maybe it lasted for a year, and I don't know if it was part of a bigger cruise line. I think it was kind of an independent. It was just like a one boat operation type thing. But again, it was the '80s. I was five or whatever, but then nothing in Klawock. And I think this is the summer that there's going to be another one coming back in. So, Hoonah was kind of like one of the first smaller communities that started getting cruise ship traffic. When did that start?
That was, they had a couple feelers in like 2000, I want to say 2004, 2005. And then I graduated high school in 2006 and was a bike tour guide that summer working for Icy Strait Point, which is the private cruise destination.
Bike tour guide. What was that like?
Oh, terrible. Like trying to herd cats. No one was listening. They were just doing whatever they wanted to. And it was like the cheapest tour. And it was like you get this like lowest common denominator person that just wants to go do something, but they don't want to spend money. But then, you know, maybe they don't really want to go biking, or maybe a few of the people don't want to go biking. And so they're all, you know, one of them's loving it, but the other ones are grumpy, or it was just bikes were always breaking. People were always breaking bikes.
Are they e-bikes or pedal?
Oh, back then it was just all pedal bikes.
Brutal.
They were nice. They were nice little bikes, but, you know, I think there was like probably 30 something bikes and half of them were broken at any given time.
Yeah. I always had a couple of students per year that do kayak tours, and they're just amazed by how many people off the cruise ships get in the kayak, and they're just terrified because they like the idea of a kayak. But actually getting in the kayak is terrifying. And then there's some people who just don't want to row or they don't want to paddle. So I didn't think I'd have to paddle. And so you got this 17-year-old kid trying to explain to an adult that, well, kayaking involves paddling. And to get to where we're going to get, we have to go, and we have to go together. But that's a great job for teenagers to have. You learn about managing people, and you maybe learn about the type of adult that you don't want to become.
Yeah, that was kind of bike tour guiding was kind of the same as kayak tour guiding. It's like, yeah, that's a little hill right there. You're going to have to pedal up and over it.
Ugh, brutal, brutal. I never had a job in the tourism industry. I worked at a pizza place in Craig, and then I worked at the fish hatchery in Klawock. So stayed clear of all that. But, you know, it's always good to have that horrible job to start off with as a starting point, and you start to establish the standards and think, okay, this is not what I want. I want something else.
Yep. My first job was when they were developing that point, and it was we'd go get driven into the forest and pick moss for landscaping stuff and shove it in big garbage bags and then throw it on this big trailer and then come back to the port and then, you know, sprinkle it around. Whoa. I was like, this sucks. I hate this. And then they put us on the trail building crew, which was a little dump truck would come dump out a huge pile of gravel, and like four kids with shovels would spread it all out and spread it down the, like, make a trail basically. And by the time you were done shoveling, the next truck would show up. And I didn't like that either. So those were good jobs to learn what I didn't want to do in the future.
Yeah. The difference between jobs and a career, right?
Yep, those were means to an end.
Yeah. How did the people there respond to tourists? I know some of the smaller communities want to steer clear of it. They feel that the larger communities like Ketchikan and Juneau have sold their souls to the cruise ship lines. But with not a whole lot of other things going on, you know, fishing isn't what it used to be. Obviously, logging is, you know, a fraction of what it used to be. This is kind of one of the main, if you want to have infrastructure, if you want to have a vibrant community, you have to throw in at the cruise ships. How did the community, or how has it adjusted?
Initially, I think a lot of people were pretty divided as like, we don't want to become the, Disneyland, adventure park basically. But then they also, the same people, it's pretty easy to point out other communities that have gone through the same commercial fishing and then logging heavy industries. And then Hoonah did the same thing, lots of logging, lots of commercial fishing, but the fleet is a fraction of what it used to be. There's basically no logging anymore. And without those, younger people leave and bring their families with them. Mm-hmm. And school sizes dwindle, and then school funding dwindles. And then for the people that do have good jobs, it's less attractive to raise a family here.
Yeah.
And Hoonah kind of staved that off a little bit by embracing tourism. So, you know, basically anyone that wants a job that can get up and be on time can have a job out at Icy Strait Point or through one of the other independent businesses. And even then they still have to bring in a lot of outside help. Mm-hmm. Just to fill all the jobs. So, you know, economic security is that's key for our economic security.
Yeah. I remember, I think all the teachers at the elementary and high school in Kluwak were within like 5 years of coming up. They all kind of came up together and they brought the families because it was attractive to move to Alaska and teach. It was the oil boom and the blank check era. So it was so great for a lot of families to bring up their families and just have this nice vibrant existence. But like you said, with everything going out, then the cities kind of dry up and then you don't have people who they might want to come back, but you don't have that vibrant social, healthy, economical thing to come back to. And so the people who graduate leave and don't come back, and it's hard to attract new people. I know Prince of Wales was unique in that it's connected by road to a bunch of other communities. So Kluwak being 600 people and Craig being 2,500 people, you know, 6 miles away, and then you can drive to Thorne Bay and you can drive to Kaufman Cove. So you kind of had an island community, but you know, obviously that's not possible for Hoonah. And now with things kind of drying up in Kaufman and Thorne Bay and Craig and Kluwak just a little bit, you know, there's really not much to attract people to go there. There's some ecotourism a little bit. The cruise ships are just kind of you kind of have to do that, you know, and there's no daycare either. Like that's a huge thing. If you want to get a family to move there, it doesn't matter if you're trying to recruit people or trying to influence people to go there. If they can't bring their family, there's no daycare, then it's no deal.
Yeah, exactly. It has to be every aspect has to be there.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, sir. No, go ahead.
What's the road system like there? Because I know you're on Chichagof, and that's a pretty stinking huge island. But can you get around on a lot of those old logging roads?
Yeah, so there's there's three separate road systems that are not connected to each other that originate in Port Frederick, which Hoonah is at the mouth of Port Frederick. And then you go a little further up Port Frederick, and there's another like landing where they did logging on the other side. That road network's goes about 13 miles with some branches. And then there's another one at the head of Port Frederick that kind of cuts back around the corner, and it actually overlooks Tenneke Inlet a little bit, the upper part of Tenneke Inlet. That one's probably eight or nine miles of road. And then the main logging roads, what everyone calls the logging roads, is like you can go 22-ish miles out to like False Bay area, which is in Chatham. And then you can drive the other way at the Y, which is close to town. And you can go 25 miles to Freshwater Bay, which also empties into Chatham. But you're basically going two different ways around the northern part of Chichagof. Mm-hmm. But the roads don't actually take you to any other towns. They're just that like arterial network that goes out to, that was to just to harvest logs.
Yeah. That's kind of too bad. Like if it was all connected, it'd be nice to be able to access that. One of the main benefits of Prince of Wales, there's so many old logging roads. You can get to at least the north 2/3, that lower third you have to fly out to get to. But yeah, mm-hmm. being able to drive to different steelhead rivers or salmon rivers and hunting and fishing, it kind of spreads people out a little bit.
Yeah, it's, you know, it does open up a ton of access. When my dad was growing up here, there before the logging roads, really, that network expanded. It was, if you wanted to go alpine deer hunting, you either went by boat or and to a mountain that ended right at the beach, or you really had to hike a long ways to get to them. Mm-hmm. So as far as like alpine hunting and, you know, steelhead fishing too, and it's opened up a couple rivers that have steelhead in the spring.
Have you seen much traffic coming in for steelhead or for deer hunting?
For deer hunting, yeah, there's quite a few people that come in from all over the place. For steelhead fishing, not really. There's a few guys that come over for a little bit here and there. Maybe some, like my friends are going to come over for a couple days. I know another buddy's got some friends coming over. But it's, you know, it's a couple of guys for a couple of days. It's, there's no, you know, it's not commercialized. There's no lodge. But there's also not that many fish. So yeah. It's not like Yakutat where you can just fly straight in and 30 minutes later, you're, you know, looking at fish under the bridge.
Yeah. And it's not like I've never been up there. Is it as good as everybody says?
It's an amazing river in that the entire river is almost perfect spawning gravel. It's a amazing place, and I think it's worth seeing at least once if you're a serious steelhead fisher. I've been up there a couple of times and hit the timing and the weather basically right both times, and have had pretty good success, but it's also pretty crowded.
Yeah.
And like we floated it one day, and when we stopped in like midday, there was probably like, I bet you 60 people floated past
Whoa.
Us.
Wow. That's more than I even thought.
Yeah. It was at least there's more than 10 boats of guys floating by, and then people in their own pack rafts and people in their own like little cataracts and stuff. And this is a lot of pressure, but there's a lot of fish. You'll see 100 fish a day, mm-hmm. which is, you know, unheard of in any other river.
Yeah. That's kind of like the annual run for some rivers is 100, maybe two in some areas, or sometimes it's just a couple dozen, but yeah, that's kind of what I'm used to. If I see a couple other people, then that constitutes a busy day. But the solitude is kind of what I associate steelhead fishing with. So I don't know, that'd be kind of tough to deal with. But you know, I think sometimes it is what it is, and you can enjoy it for what it is. You don't have to be, you know, if you have a bad attitude, then that's just going to make it worse.
Yeah, and knowing that there's a lot of people there, just get up earlier and hike further before you start fishing. You know, it's tempting to hike to the first spot and start fishing, but that locks you into fishing, you know, there, and you can't make it that, you know, you don't make it up to the far reaches where maybe nobody else makes it. Or so when I've gone up there, knowing that there's going to be a lot of people, we just either hiked way out or floated quick down and then started fishing midway rather than starting fishing right at the top and going slow. But yeah, I've been to see the SeaTac twice. That was enough.
Do you, when you're fishing that river, do you fish it similar to the other rivers, or because the traffic, do you fish it a little bit differently? Sometimes if I know that there might be some other people around, I kind of hit the spots that I know and then try to hit the next spot before that other person gets there. So I get the quick bite in one spot and hit the spot number two just in case. But if no one else is around, I fish things a little bit more slowly and methodical. How does your fishing change based on traffic or even season or water flow or whatever?
Oh, around Hoonah, there's really nobody else. There's, like I said, there's a couple guys that fish a little bit, but we talk to each other and communicate and basically never bump into each other, you know, by chance at the river. So not really stepping on each other's toes, here, but in like Yakutat, the first time that I went, I was just exploring. I didn't know anything. We didn't go guide or anything. We just showed up and started fishing and had been given pointers by other people of, you know, go up there, do this, do that, and, or start here, like park here and then hike up that way. So the first time we're just kind of exploring, and figuring things out. But then the second time I definitely hustled up to like a couple spots first thing in the morning. And I'd say it didn't matter so much on the SeaTech because there's literally so many fish and so many places to fish. But I think my schedule changed the most probably on like the Anchor River, where there's not as many places that are good fishing spots, but a lot of pressure, like lots of like per fish, way more pressure than the SeaTech River.
What type of rod are you using?
Just using Echo Ion. I think I have the newer XL, and I've got a 9 foot 9 weight, but I use the 10 foot 8 weight.
Okay.
And basically all just short casts or roll casts and flips. Sometimes little bow and arrow casts into like little tight spots, with jigs or beads or little really heavy streamers that'll get down quick. But nothing fancy. That way if I break something, I don't have to cry about it too much.
I really like using that longer rod, so even if it is a smaller piece of water, you just get a lot more kick with the roll cast. You got a lot more reach, and it can be kind of a pain to go through the bushes. But I just kind of like that extra little rod and, lots of mending, you can just really sweep it up river. So it's nice. We got, a 10 foot, 10 inch switch rod that we like to use. It's a 7 weight, and that's pretty nice, on some of the medium rivers, some of the big rivers it can work too. But yeah, otherwise it's a single handed 7 weight, for some of the smaller rivers.
Yeah. I got a 8 weight Echo Swing last year. That's 11 foot 8, and it feels like gigantic compared to the 9 or the 10 footers. But it's too big for around here. That's for swinging gear, but so it just sits in the corner waiting.
That's that kind of that down south steelhead, big old huge long runs of riffly water, and you're just chucking long casts and then make your one step. Like that's pretty fun, but I kind of like the small ball, smaller rivers. Then it's kind of hard to figure out exactly where to cast. It seems like they could be anywhere, whereas you can find these pockets and runs, and you could think, okay, there's a couple fish right there, so I can really focus on that. I get kind of overwhelmed when the water is so even and so consistent. And so it's not featureless, but it's just all good holding water. It can be, you feel almost hopeless in trying to cover it all.
Yeah. It's intimidating. I fished the Ho River and the Soul Duck and, Quinault. That's what I got this rod for, the swinging rod for. And it was basically rolled up to a spot that looked good and looked in there. I was like, ooh, geez, where's the fish going to be in this anywhere? So I just, spent 4 days just hucking and swinging and hucking and swinging. And I did hook a few fish, which I was amazed, but, it was totally different game than steelhead and tiny rivers with lots of wood.
Yeah, that Olympic Peninsula is—it's so. I've never been. Well, I've in fourth grade. I think we went on a school trip down there because the flights were like $88 round trip or something crazy like that. So we did a little tour there in fourth grade. But man, you just look at—that's like steelhead heaven, or at least used to be. 30, 40, 50 years ago. But man, those waters just look so awesome, and it's just pretty sad that they've been reduced to not a whole lot, but the water's just gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah, I think unfortunately, death by a thousand cuts for those fish.
Yeah. Is that the area that you, I think there's at least one river there that you can't even lift the steelhead from the water? Is that maybe the Skagit or one of those?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. That. Yeah, basically keep them wet and or else.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, that'd be sweet. I would love to do like a little trout tour or a steelhead tour of that, but then I just look at, I don't know if it's going to be worth the time, worth the effort, because it's not what it was. So unless you have a time machine, the same thing in California. I remember my buddies and I would go to, because I used to live in Manteca, California, just south of Sacramento. And we'd head out to the Windsor area and fish the Russian River. And yep. I mean, that was in the 50s and 60s, you'd have the people that would drive up from San Francisco and they would stay in Guerneville and Duncan's Mill and those cool areas and Monte Rio. And they just had this cool fly fishing and art culture and king salmon running up there and the steelhead running up there. So all the pictures on the in the stores and all that just show this bygone era, and you just think, man, that would have been awesome to have been here when you're catching 40-50 pound king salmon, you know, just a couple hours north of San Francisco. It's just, man,
yeah,
it's amazing.
Well, same with the spring hogs on the Columbia, you know, 90 pounders, 80.
Yeah, I can't even imagine it.
Yeah, I every once in a while my Instagram feed algorithm goes down a rabbit hole one way or the other, and this at one point this winter it was all those Argentinian king salmon, this huge monster, bright red slabs that are I think they came from University of Washington is what they were where they were transplanted from. Don't quote me on that, but basically they've thrived because they kind of fill this niche where there's no their predator base isn't there, and their food base is, and there's just, it's the perfect conditions for growing, and the big glacial rivers produce big king salmon too.
Yeah, I'm almost positive this is another one of those just facts. I don't know if I'm coming up with it or what, but the McLeod River in California has this just beautiful, like, quintessential perfect look to its rainbow trout, and that was used to stock and transplant all across the United States. And I think that the McLeod River's what they transplanted down to Argentina or the Patagonia area, so that would make sense if you got the king salmon from Washington and you got rainbow trout from California, just that beautiful strand, and they just took to it and it's beautiful. But yeah, it's I'd like to go down there, but I just don't even know how that would even work. You hear about the guided trips down there are so different too, because like when you stop for lunch you get like a full line, they get tables out and a tablecloth and there's like sausage and some wine and, you know, maybe even a siesta, like they do it right.
Yeah, I think it sounds pretty easy as far as that goes. Just bring your checkbook.
You're right. Whole bunch of IOUs, Dumb and Dumber style.
Yeah, IOU. No, I'll trade you. You can come king salmon fishing up here.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. Yeah, I think it's David Coggins' book, The Optimist, that I was reading about him going down there. There's always like some of the iconic riders have made their trip down there. It sounds awesome, but there's just so many other things I want to do first. I haven't even been to Bristol Bay, so I'd have to go there first before I start heading to South America, I think.
Yeah. New Zealand's on my list, ahead of Argentina. The Bolivian Dorado, Golden Dorado look really good. That looks super fun too. But yeah, the list is long and I'm sure I'm never going to get to them all.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all right. That's, kind of what happens there. You can't do everything.
No. And maybe we talked about this last time too, but it's like, we're leaving fish to go chase fish. Like, yeah. I'm leaving. Yeah. If I left there, I'd be leaving a, you know, world class fishing to go somewhere else where there's world class fishing.
Yeah, I think what would have to happen, it would have to be during the winter. So that way you're not sacrificing some great fishing here. Like you endure the winter here just to leave somewhere else during the summer. I did that a little bit when Abby was getting her PhD in Wyoming, and we had a lot of fun trout fishing for big rainbows and big brown trout in Idaho and Wyoming and Colorado. But we still got a couple weeks on each end, the first for the kings, and then at the end of the summer with the cohos. So it wasn't I didn't totally miss out, but kind of that middle section there was when we were down south. But yeah, I think Christmas Island or something like that, or somewhere warm during January seems just about what the doctor ordered.
Yeah, especially I went to Belize this January, first part of January. That was pretty nice because it was cold and miserable here, and shorts and t-shirt weather there, and it was great.
Yeah. So another thing that we look at here or look forward to in the spring is grouse season. Have you been out much? My wife and I went out once and I smoked a branch.
I've only been out one time so far. My girlfriend is living with me here in Hoonah for the summer, and she's a nurse at the clinic here, and so she was only getting a few days off here and there. So I've been kind of sticking close to the home, but we did get to go over to the mainland last Sunday, and we took her two dogs that are 9 and 8 year old Frenchies, French bulldogs, which are not probably the worst bird dog that there is, but I drug them up the hill, and ended up getting one. But it was probably the hardest. What the first one was by far the hardest to find that I found, and then didn't get. I never did get a shot at it. It was a real tough spot. And I normally would have just gave up on it and moved to the next one, but I knew the little guys weren't the little dogs weren't going to make it very far, so I didn't. I really wanted to get that one and not have to go very far.
Yeah, it's hard once you get close because then the whole thing starts again. It's almost like the first half is the easy half. That's getting you in the vicinity. And then if they're walking around, it sounds like you're, 100 yards away. And then you get to the same side of the tree as they're on. And then all of a sudden they're right there. You can feel the sound. And then they walk around again and you're just looking up, looking up, looking up. And yeah, like you said, sometimes you finally find it, but there's just no shot. I had a pretty tight window, went for it and knocked it off the branch and it flew down. And then it got a closer shot, an easier shot, but then I just didn't even see the branch and smoked it. And Abby was filming with her camera and you could just
You
see.
just see the branch.
Yeah, I was like, "How did I m Oh, yeah, blasted that thing." Yeah, that's what happens, I guess.
Yeah, my program basically is when I'm approaching the grouse, what I do is I, as I'm getting close and I'm like, all right, now it's getting really loud. It's got to be up here, and I've got maybe 10 degrees off this direction, 10 degrees off this direction. It's in that stand, and I walk till I pass it basically. Until it's all of a sudden it sounds like it's behind me. I'm like, okay, I just passed it. So it's one of these in this little stand. Find a good place to toss the backpack down and swap to binoculars and then start doing circles, trying to spot it, trying to listen for it. And once I hone in on which, maybe one or two trees, then I start really looking in, like looking at the tree by getting further away from it, getting uphill. Doing all the tricks and that you can do to try to give yourself the advantage of finding it. But unfortunately that first one that we came across, it was just the hillside wasn't very steep, and there were several trees right around it that were pretty thick, with branches, and I didn't have a lot of good looks into the tree. And then it was a tall tree. And the bird was moving. So, had I been sitting in one spot, I might have seen it, but I was moving, the bird was moving, and when I finally did see it, I was like, oh, there he is. Okay. So he's right there in the tree on this side of the tree, went and got the gun, came back, and it was gone. It was still hooting, but it had moved into a different spot. And that's when I said, all right, we got to pull the plug on this one. So he's still up there.
Yeah, that's I really like it when the last little bit of the terrain is steep. Is like you said, you can get up past it, and then rather than looking straight up from like underneath the tree, you're uphill and you're looking more out, and that just makes it so much easier to look through. Because right at the base of the tree, if you're trying to look up that, you're not going to see anything. You're just going to be branches in the way. So it's nice to figure those sort of things out, and then it feels like you have a chance once you get kind of past it, and then you're looking around. But then, of course, yeah, as I said, it can get a little bit frustrating when stuff doesn't go your way. But again, that's happens.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. Well, I knew that. I've gone to that area. This is the fourth time that I've gone to the exact area, and my Gaia track line looks like a whole bunch of little circles, yeah, and like right next to each other. And both of the grouse that we found were, you know, 50 yards or less, maybe 20 yards away from other grouse that I've got in the past in those exact spots. So whatever it is about that spot is just a good calling spot for the male grouse. But I know when I'm going to go there, it's going to be tough to find them. But I still keep going there because it's literally the closest spot to Huna that there's grouse. And yeah, it's not too high of elevation to climb to.
Yeah. There's the closest spot that I've found them. It's in the back of this little bowl, and I will never go there again because there was one on both sides, but then you also get a little bit of an echo. And oh my gosh, it was horrible. There was blowdown. It was Devil's Club. Horrible, just horrible. And I just felt like it was just ping pong. I was just going back and forth and trying to make my way up and miserable. So I stay out of those areas. Even if I do hear one, I'm like, not doing that. And then also learned if it's down the road from you, like it seems like you can just drop down, no big deal. But man, I don't go, I go uphill off the road. I don't go downhill.
Oh yeah. It's a lot more, harder at the front end to go up, but it's a lot nicer to go come home going down.
Yeah. Especially sure. if you're frustrated or you're pissed off a little bit. Yeah. You don't want to be going uphill. It's nice to just kind of, all right, well, at least this hike's going to be pretty easy.
Yeah. The spot that I've been going to is, lower elevation and not very steep. So it's pretty easy to get to, but you pay for it with brush, and then the trees that they are in are pretty tall, so it ends up being an easy hike but a tough hunt. Some other places that if I had more time, or if we weren't doing just like basically like a half day hunt, I'd cover a little more ground, get up into that steeper area, and then you hike hard once, and then you can just side hill, you know, for a long ways and kind of go through the zone where grouse are and hopefully pick up a couple before you drop back down again. But yeah, I just did that one. We'll probably hopefully go a couple more times before the season ends. I always say I'm going to go grouse hunting a lot, and it ends up just one thing or another kind of comes up, and it's just a little more difficult to grouse hunt here in Huna than it was when I was living in Juneau. That was like after work, you could go, go run up a mountain somewhere and be in the zone for at least an hour or two before you had to hustle back down.
Yeah. Yeah. It gets tough in the spring because you want to go grouse hunting, but you also want to maybe go steelhead fishing. And if the conditions are right, if the water's up, you think, man, there's got to be some steelhead around. So why would I go for grouse when there's steelhead? But then also sometimes it's just a nice weekend to camp, and sometimes the camping area isn't the steelhead area. And then other times, you know, we've been working on getting all the stuff in the greenhouse growing, so it's a yard work day, and you feel a good amount of satisfaction from, you know, doing chores around the house outdoors. So it's, yeah, it just, the weeks just start to go deceptively fast. And before you know it, it's like, wow, I thought I was going to fish a ton for steelhead and then also go for grouse and everything. But now, you know, we're almost at May, and you know, I've made 2 steelhead trips and a couple grouse trips, but you know, it wasn't what I thought it would be. But you know, there's a lot of things going on, and I'm certainly not like miserable or anything like that. It just sometimes doesn't work out.
Yep. Yeah. Spring's definitely the busiest time. Most opportunities to do wildly different things, and you know, definitely stretched between them all.
Yeah. I don't do multiple things really well. There have been times where I thought I should bring my 22 while I'm steelhead fishing, but then what am I going to do? Am I going to leave, if I got this river all to myself and the weather's great, am I going to leave that to go after that hooter back up behind the river? Probably not, you know, and then otherwise I'm just carrying around this 22. So I think it's better to just hear the bird and ignore it than to carry around a 22 and be tempted.
Yeah. A couple years ago we went, pack rafted and hiked up a river and, steelhead fished for a little bit and trout fished, and then floated back down, motored across, and got a couple grouse. And then we were going to try king salmon trolling on the way back, but we was just kind of running out of time by the time we did both of those things. That would have been a really cool triple header adventure, but even just that was just, that took the entire day.
Yeah, that's a nice expedition.
Mm-hmm.
Do much in the way of bear hunting? It seems my buddy Ryan and I we go out and we camp and just watch bears. We haven't even really tried to, we've made some stalks, but haven't been really angry at it for a couple of years.
My uncle came down last spring and got a brown bear, and I was with him. I was taking him out and doing that with him. He was actually on Tyler Friel's podcast and did a little episode about that. It's kind of pretty, really fun hunt. I don't really do much brown bear hunting, but it's, you know, hunting just like any other kind of hunting. Play the wind, play the, you know, stay hidden. It was really exciting. But I don't really do that much. I wouldn't have done it if he didn't come down.
Yeah, it's a good excuse to get out and camp. That's for sure. And that's kind of what we're looking for when we do that.
Yeah, there's
mosquitoes aren't horrible, so that's always nice.
Yeah, we're close enough here, and it's just black brown bears for us here.
You don't have black bears?
Nope, just Chichagof is just browns. We can actually get home, you know, every night. So we were just staying at my house, and we were just going out in the afternoon and putting out somewhere and then glassing from the boat or getting off and hiking over into like a little grassy flats and watching for a little while. But even the evening that we did get a bear, we had that, you know, cleaned and skinned and back to the boat, and we drove home, you know, in the dark, basically with my spotlight on, but we were back by, you know, 10:30 or something.
Nice. Yeah, when you can day trip, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah, just it helps with the logistics of stuff, and my little boat that we were going out on has a nice berth and bunk up front. So if we did want to just anchor up and camp for a few hours till it got light in the morning, if we were further away, it would have been no problem to do that.
Yeah, nice. So you getting really excited about the cruise ship action coming? Have you guys been getting ships yet?
Yeah, there has been a few ships already. There's quite a bustle and hustle around town of when that's in. I think I said we hadn't started yet. We'll start first week of May. Okay. But I'm looking forward to it. It's good. It's nice to kind of get back into that swing of things.
Mm. We had 2 today. This is our first day with 2. We had last Thursday and the previous Thursday we had 1 ship, so now it's I think we have 2 days in between, and then I think the 30th it's just on until September
until the end of September.
Yeah,
yeah. I've our our ship schedule's a little more sporadic until that. I think May 6th is our first day, and then that's kind of when it like goes to like full on like busy schedule at that point. The ships have come online by then.
What's your max ship per day?
Ooh. Well, initially they were saying, oh, it's only going to be one ship a day. It'll never be more than one ship a day. And then quickly it was, there's money, two ships a day.
Money. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, can't blame them too much.
No. Why not?
And then I think now there's some days where there might be four cruise ships in a day. And like two will be in kind of early in the morning. And then a third one will come in, and then there might be another pretty small ship, maybe tender in or something that stays kind of later. Mm-hmm. But it is typically just one or two. And then I think every Tuesday there's, or maybe every other Tuesday there's three. I don't really look at, once we set our schedule for the year, I forget about the actual cruise schedule.
Doesn't
and just
matter.
Look at what time I got to be showing up and, you know, what time I've got my tours for every day.
Yeah. I think we get six are our big days, so we're looking at 15,000-16,000 people off the ships. I think this is the first summer that Juno is capped. I think they capped at five. They're still getting, I think, over 2 million over the summer. I think we were at 1.9, I think, last summer, and we're going to be at that, if not a little higher. So it's, I mean, why cap it if you can make the money, but at the same time, you do want to, you know, protect some semblance of normalcy in town. So, I don't know, it's kind of a double-edged sword to a degree.
I've heard Sitka's been pretty hostile to buses and stuff going through town, and how much it's disrupting the feel of Sitka.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for Hoonah, there's like 900 people that live here, more, you know, a few more, a couple hundred more in the summer. But when you have 900 people and three full size cruise ships, and then maybe another little one, that's like a lot more cruise people per capita than Juno or Ketchikan or Sitka endure. Yeah. So I can't sympathize too much with them, just to say, like, could be worse.
Yeah. When we double our population, but yeah, when you guys are tripling it, that's at least tripling it, if not more. That's different. But I don't know. That's where we're at right now, and having the opportunity to actually make some money. Some of those rural areas in Alaska where they're contemplating mines, because that's the only real thing they can do to bring in revenue to some of those areas. So I'd definitely take take tourism over having to go to mining.
Yeah. Yep, exactly.
If someone did want to book a tour, are you all through the cruise ships, or are you independent of that?
We're totally independent.
So how would people book if they wanted to?
They would have to go to our website. It's g-win.com. And basically from there, you'd have to cruise around and most likely call my mom. She does most of the booking stuff in season. And we're probably full for most. A lot of our tours are full, or maybe we've got one or two spots here or there. Online booking is the way to go for sure.
Yeah, that's how things are. I got a buddy who, they do some rentals and some charter fishing, and like they're booked 2 or 3 years out. It's crazy just how many people they rebook. They come up here, they fish, and they rebook for the same week the next year or the following year, and they get their buddies to go. So I think a lot of it's like 75% to 80% is just people that they've already had come up, and that's just makes it super nice. It's just built in bookings.
Yep.
But people that come off the cruise ships who don't have stuff planned, who are looking for just a walk down the dock and, hey, can you take me out fishing? That just doesn't exist.
No, not as much anymore. Every once in a while, if we have a last minute cancellation or something, we'll put a little sign up at the end of the driveway. quite often someone will see it and call and book right away. I have had a couple people walk down to the dock while we're sitting there waiting for our passengers, and like I can see on the manifest that we've got 12 people or 11 people, and there's like a couple or one dude that just wants to go do something. It's like, well, actually you could come today. But that's, you know, that happens only a couple times a summer.
Yeah. Well, cool, man. What else you got? It's been nice talking to you as always.
Yeah, I don't know. We're going to do a little steelhead fishing this week. Now that we're done with the boat chores and stuff, we'll play for a little bit till the season starts. So I'll probably update you on that once we get back from that little trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely send some pictures and I'll see if I can figure out where it is, but probably not. I'm not as meticulous as you. I tell the stories of your sleuthing to pretty much everybody that's a hunter. I'm like, hey man, my buddy up in Hoonah, he's got a lot of free time and he's pretty meticulous. He will find where you're hunting.
But yeah, that's, now it's like a point of pride if I can find it. So that's right. Don't care. I'm not going to go there. Don't really have that interest, but where is it? But
it's a good positive noteworthy habit to have, or a hobby to have during the winter.
Yep. Are you guys going to make it up this way at all this summer?
Juneau for sure in June. And then I'm not sure about the Hoonah thing. There was Abby's going to Sitka for sure. So yeah, we'll see how things shake out. But yeah, there's still a chance. I think it's a less likely than it was, but yeah, we'll see. And if so, they might tag along.
All right. Yeah, sure. Well, always welcome.
Yeah, thanks, man. Appreciate it. It'd be cool to be there when it's not February. I was up there once in high school for basketball in February, and it was not great, but that's
yep. That's why you want to go to Belize in the winter.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But cool, man. Good to talk to you. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.